From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers of the Tree of Life Synagogue at that huge interfaith vigil last night in Pittsburgh, offering a memorial prayer for the 11 members of his flock shot and killed on Saturday. Don't know how he got through that. The suspected gunman behind the attack is expected to appear in court later today to face hate crime charges. NPR correspondent Quill Lawrence is in Pittsburgh. And Quill, I'm wondering if you can just share with us, you know, sights and sounds that you've observed and heard that might communicate to us what's going on there.
Yeah, the neighborhood of Squirrel Hill in many ways looks normal. It's a beautiful green, very diverse neighborhood with churches and lots of synagogues, predominantly Jewish, but you can really see that people from all walks of life live there. And in some ways they're getting back to normal, going to school, the Jewish community center, where it seems like everyone in town goes to use the gym or to meetings that was reopened today. But there's also people just feeling like places that they've always assumed were safe maybe aren't safe anymore. And there were people talking about how they're going to change their behavior, if at all, about vowing not to change their behavior, not letting this attack change their way of life.
Yeah. I mean, it's just got to be a city in shock. Four of the six who were wounded on Saturday are still in the hospital. Do we know their status?
People keep talking about two of the worshipers who were wounded and are in critical condition, clinging to life. Mm-hmm. At the gathering last night, one of the rabbis identified Daniel Ledger, who's 70 years old, of Squirrel Hill, who's a nurse and said that he is clinging to life and to pray for him. There have been people trying to volunteer, trying to give blood. Of course, far more volunteers than people know what to do with at this stage, but the community wants to try and help.
And what are people saying about the two police officers who are, I think, still hospitalized, four were wounded, who confronted the shooter at the door of the synagogue as he was leaving, and all four wounded?
Yeah, I mean, there's been an outpouring of gratitude towards all of the first responders. And you see police now on corners all over the city, outside of synagogues and public places, and a lot of people just stopping by to show their appreciation. These guys, they rushed towards someone who was armed with what we now know were three 357 pistols and an AR-15 assault rifle, which is designed for gunfights. It's designed to kill people. And they went into the hail of bullets. Two of them were, or rather three of them were hit by bullets, and one was hit by shrapnel and glass.
The victims, from the very old, 97, to the middle-aged. And one we know through friends was a beloved doctor. What more? I mean, this is a small, Pittsburgh's a small town.
So. Yeah, and Squirrel Hill is very small. Everyone there knows of someone. There were two brothers in their 50s, Cecil Rosenthal and David Rosenthal, who were they lived together in an apartment. They had intellectual disabilities, clearly dearly loved by this community, always around the community center and always at this synagogue. People talk about them a lot. Bernice Simon and Sylvan Simon were a married couple. They were married at the Tree of Life Synagogue, by my count, 62 years ago. Mm-hmm. In December would have been their anniversary. I mean, these are vulnerable people, but I mean, this is your grandma and your grandpa.
Yeah.
They're older people who were killed.
Their alleged murderer was a clear, at least to police officers, anti-Semite. He said things to them like, "I just want to kill Jews," posted anti-Semitic messages on Gab.com, which is a right-wing message board that allows this kind of language, even said that he was going in, meaning going in to do this act. He also seemed to assign to Jewish people the caravan that's of immigrants that's coming, or it's very far away from the border, but that's heading towards the border.
Yeah, Robin. I mean, you've almost listed everything we know about him in that question. Huh. In a way, there's really, in this day and age where you expect to find a long chain of posts on Facebook or something where you can almost see someone develop, or even in many cases you'd expect to see the a criminal record. We've got very little on this guy. The post that he made did seem to echo some sentiments that have been made by some politicians about there being globalists, particularly George Soros, behind this caravan, these debunked conspiracy theories. But we don't know much about him.
Yeah. Well, the 11 victims, his 11 victims, his alleged 11 victims, will be buried beginning tomorrow, we understand, briefly.
Yeah. And I mean, I just want to say the way this community has come together is very impressive. The gathering last night, we saw people from all faiths coming and saying that the Jewish community had helped them in the past and they want to return the favor.
Yeah. NPR's Quil Lawrence, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, yesterday, President Trump called to congratulate far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro, who was elected president of Brazil on Sunday. Supporters hope he brings sweeping change to Latin America's largest country, which is struggling with rising unemployment, crime, and corruption. But Bolsonaro is also a very polarizing figure. He's been called the Trump of the tropics. Joining us now is the BBC's Julia Cardinero in Rio de Janeiro. Hi, Julia.
Thank you.
Bolsonaro, we could tick off his extremist views over the years about women, extremist views about gay people, about black people, and at times he's even suggested that he supports a dictatorship in Brazil. How polarizing is the new president-elect of Brazil?
Well, he is a figure that's built his career with a very aggressive rhetoric, aggressive towards minorities. He is a former military army captain, and so he has defended the military dictatorship in the past. He has paid homage to a figure that was a torturer during the dictatorship in Congress. And this speech that usually resorts to intolerance and that usually talks about incriminating his opponents. Just a week before he was elected, he spoke of wiping the Workers' Party, the left-wing Workers' Party supporters from the face of Brazil, is highly polarizing and is seen with fear amongst people who voted against him. So it is quite a delicate moment for Brazil and an unprecedented moment in Brazilian history.
So how did he rise to prominence so quickly? Because this is a man who also spent decades in Brazil's Congress without much of a legislative record.
Yes, precisely. He really grew through his attacks towards the Workers' Party and was fueled by the huge anger and, I think it's fair to say, hatred that spread towards the Workers' Party in Brazil after massive corruption scandals that have emerged over the past years. So the Workers' Party, a left-wing party, was in government for 13 years. People will remember the government of former President Lula. Lula is now in prison since April this year.
On corruption and, charges.
On corruption charges, yes. And he's facing other charges as well. And many people in Brazil are just fed up with the Workers' Party and think that they are to blame for the economic recession that we're facing, for the huge levels of unemployment, and for the problems that we're facing right now.
Well, let's just tick through some of the problems that Brazil is facing. You mentioned the economy, 13 million unemployed in the country, and violence is a major issue in this election. 63,000 murders last year, one of the worst murder rates in the world.
Yes, and Bolsonaro has really capitalized these issues and has been speaking a lot about the issue of public security, saying that he's going to take a hard line stance against violence. And with this, he has often said that a police should not be punished by killing while on duty if they're doing their jobs. So he's someone who defends the reduction, for instance, of the age of criminal responsibility in Brazil from 18 to 16 years of age. He defends that people should be able to own weapons and to be able to defend their own families from criminals. So these conservative ideas have appealed to many Brazilians who saw him as someone promising change and someone who is presenting himself as someone who's going to do something different.
What does the victory say, this hard shift to the right, say about what's happening all across Latin America? Because Bolsonaro is only the latest example of a conservative leader emerging in a region that for many, many years was known for politics on the left.
Exactly. We are seeing this wave of conservative governments and parties that we see in Europe, that we see across the globe, that we see in Trump now enter South America with Bolsonaro, and his rise here in Brazil is bound to influence parties in other parts of the continent. One of the big campaign statements that he's made is that Brazil cannot be the next Venezuela. He's been propagating this idea that he's against communism, he's against socialism, and his entrance into government means that Brazil is getting rid of that. The problem is, Peter, that we saw several aggressions happening in the run-up to the elections towards opponents of Bolsonaro. And what people fear is what this hate speech can trigger in the population in general, whether people who are more conservative might feel empowered to be violent towards gay people, towards minorities, even if Bolsonaro tries to soothe these words as he becomes president.
And he does have an ally in President Trump who called Bolsonaro to congratulate him on his victory. That's the BBC's Julia Carneiro in Rio de Janeiro. Julia, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
Jewish leaders speaking out about the 11 killed, 6 wounded in Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue, one of the deadliest attacks on Jews in American history, are all noting it reflects an increase in hate crimes across the country. Jack Rosen is president of the American Jewish Congress. Jack, words fail. You know, we're so sorry about this wound to your community. But has this been in the back of your mind? You know, what were you thinking when you heard about this attack?
My first thought was this was a brutal anti-Semitic killing attack, not only on Jews, but Americans and our values. And the shock of it all was Jews have been living in America comfortable, accepted in all communities around the country. A sea change since the 50s and 60s and in anti-Semitism and bigotry against Jews and many minorities. And here we are again, one more time. This ugliness has not only popped to the surface, it does periodically. But it seems to have gripped a good number of people in America.
Well, let's talk about the climate in which it occurred. Jews make up about 2% of this country's population. The FBI data says they account for about half the country's religious hate crimes. According to the Anti-Defamation League, that's nearly 2,000 incidents in 2017, 500 more than the previous year. Have you been feeling that increase?
In the last 2-3 years, we see more anti-Semitic acts. Nazi symbols on Jewish cemeteries or schools. This act on Saturday is quite a shock to the community and to America, it seems.
And, you know, you saw the gathering there in Pittsburgh. Thousands of people came out. I hope you're feeling that support from across the board. And yet we heard the president say in his first remarks, it's hard to believe that this could happen in this day and age. I mean, you're saying somewhat the same thing, except you're saying that you are also aware of a rise in incidents. Do you think that maybe, possibly, this horrific act on Saturday, that maybe at the very, very least, you know, small consolation, but there can be a moment of people understanding that there is anti-Semitism in this country?
Yeah, I'm fearful that unless we mobilize, unless our political leadership decides to change its ways, there won't be any major changes taking place. You know, there's an opportunity next week when we vote in America. Maybe those that have been spewing out some of this viral language, you know, politicians, those who have not spoken out against intolerance, against minorities, and maybe that'll send a message and shock the system. You know, the answer to this are our political leaders. They have the microphones, and the most important political leaders are president. He has a bully pulpit and has the biggest microphone in the country. And I think it starts with him changing the tone of how he speaks about Americans and politicians from other parties. But it also has to go down to, you know, our representatives in Washington, our governors, our mayors. You know, it's a local issue. And if we can mobilize, you know, with a loud voice to make sure that they understand that this is not the American way, that Americans won't accept it, that they'll go to the polls if necessary to change it, and it becomes a priority. That's where it has to begin. And
well, actually, some would say we're hearing the opposite from the president, have been for a while. We know that the gunman in Pittsburgh shouted the same racist rant that was heard by those marching white nationalists in Charlottesville in August of 2017. And we know that, you know, online, these white nationalists, supremacists, Nazis, absolutely believe and foment the thinking that Jews are pulling the strings somehow behind policies they don't like. Let's listen to these marchers. It's hard to hear, but let's listen to these marchers again in Charlottesville.
Will not replace us! Jews will not replace us!
A sound from a documentary that was put together that day. I mean, when you heard that's what the shooter was allegedly shouting in the synagogue, that had to be chilling.
Yes, of course, you know, coming off of Charlottesville and Charleston and other attacks, I think Americans are very conscious of the wrong tone being set in America. I know everybody speaking about the president having big responsibility in this because of, you know, his views and his political rhetoric. We should all work hard to let him know that we don't accept that in America. But it's not only him is the point I'm trying to make. I just happened to have been watching Griffin Sharpton's show on TV yesterday.
Al Sharpton on MSNBC, yeah.
Discussion tended to surround Trump, the bigotry and hatred that he's been showing and the wrong tone he's been setting. And I said to myself, what about Farrakhan?
You're speaking of Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam.
You know, he just a few weeks ago said the Jews are terrorites. Why aren't you speaking out against him? Is that because you're a Democrat and Trump's a Republican? But our political leaders should also be speaking out against, you know, hatred coming from all sides, from all parties. We can maybe hold the president a little more responsible. You know, he has to, since he has the biggest microphone, he's going to have to, you know, live with the fact that he's the one they talk about the most. But we shouldn't forget other parties. All leaders don't just get a pass here in America.
Well, President Trump said that there were fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, and some took that as permission for those marchers.
Look, I don't think that you can talk about Nazis and the alt-right and Americans. I just don't think that comparison makes, you know, any sense to any of us Americans.
Jack Rosen, president of American Jewish Congress, thanks so much. And again, so sorry for the loss in your community.
Thank you for your kind thoughts and appreciate the time to be able to express the views of the Jewish community.
Immigration officials are processing requests from business owners who want to hire foreign guest workers through the H-2B visa program. Congress has set the cap at 66,000 workers per fiscal year. An additional 15,000 visas were made available this year for businesses that could prove they face serious financial harm without foreign guest workers. But some companies are finding they can't hire enough. Matthew Casey of KJZZ reports on an Arizona-based drywall company that turned to H-2B labor as the economic recovery began and its market share grew.
Vicente and Mario Moran climbed stepladders in unison with a heavy board held over their heads. The cousins work for the company Paul Johnson Drywall, and they're in the city of Goodyear, toiling on what will eventually be homes for seniors.
One board will wear you out, so you gotta be a special kind of crazy to do this job.
Hanging vertical drywall is hard work. Fastening it to the ceiling is even tougher. From the top of the ladders, the men lift the drywall into place, hold it up with one hand, and reach for their tool belts with the other. Vicente and Mario Moran are from a family of Mexican immigrants, and relatives introduced them to this business about 15 years ago. The entry-level wage is around $27,000 a year. Top workers earn in the low six figures.
Like, as a matter of fact, our uncle's across the hall right now. You know, he's kind of one of the ones that taught us.
At first, the cousins struggled with the job's physical and mental demands, but they didn't quit. Now they are both foremen. Vicente isn't sure why more people don't tough it out.
Hey, if I had an answer to that, we wouldn't have a labor issue right now, you know?
Paul Johnson Drywall's labor shortage got more challenging this past year, says owner Cole Johnson.
We didn't get H-2B workers, and that's almost a universal story across the United States for construction for craft workers.
When a generation gap of craft workers, an industry exodus during the Great Recession, and a huge spike in market share threatened the company's ability to meet demand during the recovery, Johnson turned to foreign guest workers.
It's an extremely difficult and expensive process.
But, Johnson says, the government's process changed last year. It was less transparent. Federal officials kept asking his company for more information. So Johnson wasn't able to hire any H-2B workers. It's had an effect on his business.
There's projects on a daily basis that we declined to bid based on not having an ability to quickly enough train the workforce that we need.
Johnson thinks the problem was convincing the government that his need for guest workers was temporary and seasonal. He argues it is because, for example, the slow and busy seasons haven't changed in 50 years.
It's a very tiny program.
University of Georgia professor Cindy Hahamovich has studied H-2B visas. Hahamovich says when the H-2B program emerged in the 1980s, the idea was to help fill a need for seasonal jobs, like a cook at a resort.
But we've seen the program encroaching into industries that are simply recasting themselves as hirers of temp workers only.
Hahamovich says H-2B workers have to accept the pay and conditions of the person who hires them. Some get paid minimum wage and are even in debt when they get to the U.S. If they quit, they become undocumented. So taking a higher-paying job with better conditions is not an option. And all of this binds temporary foreign workers to their employer in a way that Americans aren't.
This is not just about labor scarcity. This is also about control of workers.
Back at the job site in Goodyear, Vicente Moran says guest workers are easier to train than Americans. Their mind is set on making it in drywall, no matter what.
You don't just have to be tough. Like, you got to be smart, too.
Paul Johnson Drywall had planned to apply again for H-2B workers in the new fiscal year. But the company recently changed course and will now invest in a relocation program for U.S. workers to keep building its labor force. The company hopes to eventually hire about 100 workers a month. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Casey.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Getting a professional haircut when you're homeless is not a priority or really even a possibility in a lot of cases, but a group of Nashville barbers wants to make sure that everyone gets a chance to look good. Natasha Senyanovich of member station WPLN reports.
War Memorial Plaza in the heart of Nashville is buzzing with activity on a Monday evening. Friends high-five, kids run around, and people joke with familiar faces. And in one corner, a row of people sit in salon chairs. They chat with stylists in gray t-shirts sporting a Nashville Street Barbers logo. The stylists are volunteers who snip, shave, and shear from 6 to 8 p.m., though the waiting list may be 30 long. Names are called out when a chair opens up.
Shannon Evans!
31-year-old veteran Shannon Evans has been struggling to get off the streets. He says he recently suffered a breakdown from the solitude of having no family and nowhere to go. To see people donating their time and talent, like the street barbers, is priceless to him.
It makes people look at me different. Like, they don't think I'm homeless as long as I don't dress nasty. And more than that, it's like somebody cares. Somebody cares.
Nashville Street Barbers was started a little over a year ago by Caroline Lindner. The full-time stylist had been organizing haircuts for nonprofits for 5 years. She was looking for a new project when she read about a group offering free showers downtown in mobile trucks and asked to join them. Lindner came alone at first and says she was terrified that she might not be well received.
I think people know when you're scared, and I think it takes a lot to trust someone with your hair, too. So it took quite a while to gain trust and to feel comfortable and to just kind of show up and attack it.
Now there might be up to a dozen barbers on a Monday night. And they get repeat customers. Some clients just ask for a trim. Others, like Clarence Branham and Tasha Hayford, are more specific.
I wanted all my hair off my neck,
and my beard and my top to be almost even.
A short pixie bob, like short in the back and long in the front.
Lindner says no project of hers has been as successful as this one. She was recently chosen to receive a $10,000 national prize, and she says she never has to nudge volunteers to show up because
this whole thing is about just being happy and helping people.
Sometimes up to 80 people come for a haircut. Not all of them live on the streets. Some, like Pete O'Connor, come because even a $20 haircut can be expensive. The formerly homeless veteran heard about the group recently and has already come twice because his hair grows fast.
I think this kind of a situation is great for people, especially if they're really, you know, like looking for a job or something. They're in a position where they need to make themselves look neat and doing what they can to take care of themselves.
Another regular customer is Cynthia Pritchard. A traveling carnival worker, Pritchard had a stroke on the job while in Chicago a couple of years ago. That depleted almost all of her savings in just months.
I came to Nashville when my money started running low because I knew I could get help here that I needed.
Pritchard lives in a camp and sleeps in a hammock with her cat, but she is getting back on her feet and recently got a job cleaning offices. As she gets her hair cut, Pritchard says she wants people with all types of skills to join the stylists.
A lot of people are just one check away from being here and get down here and learn how to help and be a mentor for somebody who could use it.
Even though she's homeless, Pritchard volunteers at a shelter, and she also tells me she's begun mentoring women trying to get off drugs. But she's interrupted by a practical matter.
I got to get this hair off my nose.
Her barber quickly dusts her off. For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Sinjanovic.
And on this day when many people are mourning, we thought we'd offer a novel about grief that also happens to be a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction. But Sigrid Nunez's exquisite novel, The Friend, is about suicide. It's also about the writing world, which the author says is a sinking raft with too many people trying to get on. And it's about a dog, a Harlequin Great Dane named Apollo. After the suicide of her friend, the narrator is asked to take his massive pet in, and they mourn together. Sigrid Nunez spoke with us last March.
There were these three strands that I wanted to bring together into the same story, and one was about the suicide of people that are very close to you, and another was my experiences as a writer and a teacher of writing. And I've always loved animals, and I have always wanted to write about animals, and I've always been interested in this human-animal bond, particularly the human-canine bond. So I saw a way that I could write a story weaving all of those strands together.
Yeah, and did you ever, and throwing in, by the way, all along the way, suddenly there's Beckett and Flannery O'Connor and Kafka, and you're quoting other moments in literature, as is written in another book. Dogs do us the honor of treating us like gods, and we respond by treating them like things.
That is a quote from J.M. Coetzee from his novel Disgrace.
And what are you trying to say about these not just overall noble creatures, but in this case, a character named Apollo, who's one of the largest dogs you can imagine, but when he first comes into the narrator's apartment, his tail is lowered like a beast of burden. What do we know about whether dogs grieve?
We do know that they do grieve because we can observe that. And we do know that, you know, that we can't explain to them, oh, the person died because he was in a car accident or something like that. You can't explain that to a dog. But they definitely do mourn. And, you know, in this book, she didn't think about this because it wasn't her idea to take in the dog. But once she has him, she realizes that he is going through a process of grieving just like her own. And that draws them very close together, and they get through it together. They help each other heal.
Yeah. I remember I had to put a little dog to sleep once, and the person who came to the house said, it's better that the other dogs see this so that they know where the dog has gone. And I thought, well, that seems odd, but so
it seems odd to me too.
Yes.
You can't say for sure that would happen.
Well, when the shot started, the injection to, you know, put him to sleep, the other dog ran from the room, jumped into the bathtub, and peeked over the top as if to say, yeah, "Has anyone noticed you're killing a dog here?" I mean, you know,
that's fascinating.
And then he did mourn afterwards.
Oh, that's fascinating. I do think that although we don't really know what's going on inside dogs' heads because we can't, and they don't have language, We know that they're smart. I think they might be many, many times smarter than we actually have thought up to this point.
But the book isn't, I mean, for those wondering, we've seen books recently that concentrate on an animal and somebody's relationship with an animal. Yours goes off. I mean, there's whole chapters where we're not hearing anything about Apollo. And every now and then you say, did something happen to the dog or is something going to happen to the dog? Because you presume it's like Old Yeller. You presume, okay, I'm bracing here. If there's a book with a dog, something's going to happen. But you go off with your narrator to other parts of her life. What were you thinking there?
She has a life outside the dog, even though during this period of mourning, she doesn't do much besides take care of the dog. I mean, he's her whole emotional life during this period.
Somebody asked her at a party, aren't you the woman who's in love with a dog?
Yeah, right. With a giggle, the woman. But also, if you are a writer, and this narrator is, a big part of your life is literature. A big part of your life is reading and thinking about what you read and talking about what you read. And so that also became a part of the book. It's a book that, you know, where you do have a person who, in trying to understand what she is going through, turns to certain writers and certain books and certain words. And that's why I quote people like Flannery O'Connor, because she's reaching out to these things. She's putting them into the narrative because she's trying to tell a story about, and all of those writers do have a part in her life as people she's read and who have influenced her and inspired her.
Yeah. All along the way, I kept thinking, I should Google this. Is it true that during the 1980s in California, there were many Cambodian women who suddenly lost their sight?
Yes,
and they'd all fled atrocities, and what they were just psychosomatically, they couldn't see anymore because of what they'd seen?
Yes, they did have psychosomatic blindness. I mean, that was the only explanation that doctors had for it.
Is it true that research has shown that it helps, I think it was damaged children or sick children, to read aloud to dogs?
Yes, that is something that has been going on in classrooms and libraries fairly recently, I think. These are therapy dogs. They know to be calm and to sit still and listen. And for the child that's having reading difficulties, the dog is listening but is not judgmental in any way. It appears to work. Mm. What it does for the dogs, I don't know, but it does seem to help the children. Yes, that's also true, yes.
You also talk about people, we talked about sight, but you also talk about people who words die in their throat because of something powerful and traumatic. That happens a couple times to our narrator. We're not going to give away the ending, except to say that we find out that the friend is all along is the dog and maybe not the mentor who committed suicide.
Or it could be both. Hmm. Or maybe the friend is the narrator.
Yeah. And what about, you've said, you know, you've loved animals, but you make your narrator a cat person who isn't sure how she feels about a dog.
Well, my narrator really does, this is something I definitely share with my narrator. She says she thinks of herself as a cat person. It's not that I love cats more than dogs. I love both species equally. But she, like a lot of other people, has trouble with this idea of dominating any animal. Mm. And you don't dominate cats. You do dominate other animals, horses, dogs. You know, at some point she says they're almost too poignant in their relations with the person. To a cat person, for example, she says, I'm a cat person. Give me a pet that can live without me. She's just much happier with the idea that her cats would easily survive her dying suddenly, whereas this dog is totally traumatized by the disappearance of his best friend.
Yeah. Dogs can be unbearably poignant, as you said. Although I'm reminded of the great essay writer, the public radio essay writer, Alice Furlow, who wrote the definitive essay on her cat dying and the only solace that she took from it. Every morning her cat would try to wake her up by knocking a pen on her head.
As they do, yes.
Yep. Her only solace is that she is now waking up and the cat's not there. It would have been more unbearable for her if the cat was still trying to, you know, with a pen, wake her up when she had gone.
Oh, yes, that's very moving.
Well, and so is this book. It's called The Friend from Sigrid Nunez. And Sigrid, I just have to ask you, it is about writers and writing and the community and the teaching of it. Can you give us one tip for those who want to wrestle a story to the ground?
the piece of advice that I really like is the simple, don't flinch. I say it because I do see a lot of very good work among my students spoiled, at least in a draft, because they've done exactly that. They have this really good story. They have this really good experience. They have very strong feelings about it. But when they get to writing it down, they get scared and they flinch and they pull away from it. And that, you know, makes it not as good a story as it could be.
Well, I would say if anybody wants to see how you can write a book about a dog that for the longest time in the book isn't really about a dog, and then suddenly it is all about a dog and, you know, with such a punch, pick up The Friend. And how much of this is you? You've told interviewers, this isn't my writing class. You know, I'm not that frustrated with student writers. But is the suicide maybe someone you did know? Because we've read the germ of this was people who you knew who were contemplating suicide.
One of the reasons why I did want to write this book was because there were several friends that I had who let me know that suicide was something that was on their minds. It's not like they were planning it next week or even next year, but it was something they had started thinking about and thinking that it eventually would happen. And in fact, I was writing this, and one of those friends did commit suicide, in fact.
Mm. And I'm imagining that some of that shock made its way into
yes.
your character. Yeah.
Yes.
Sigrid, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sigrid Nunez's novel, The Friend, is a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction. The awards will be given out November 14th.
The suspect in the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting that killed 11 people over the weekend appears in court today. So does the man police suspect of sending pipe bombs to prominent critics of President Trump. In both cases, federal investigators are looking at the men's prolific use of social media to spread their caustic ideas. Joining us now is Clint Van Zandt. He's a former FBI profiler, and he's in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Clint, welcome back.
Hi, good to be back with you.
First, I just want to ask your thoughts. It has been an incredibly difficult few days for this country as we've processed the news about this pipe bomber and now the tragedy in Pittsburgh. How is all of this weighing on you, as someone formerly involved very closely with law enforcement?
Well, unfortunately, there are tragedies going on in the United States every day. So I think the challenges for the public as well as law enforcement, we just see so many people acting out in violence where conflict resolution used to be resolved in words. Now people are turning to weapons.
Mm-hmm. Thankfully, there is a suspect in custody in the Pittsburgh shooting. He has admitted to police that he wanted to kill all Jews. But of course, the investigation is not over. FBI agents will be busy still in the coming days. What are they going to be looking for?
Well, like in both of these cases, the shooting as well as the pipe bombs through the mail, we have a case of men looking for a mission. They're trying to find a reason for their lives. Someone is, unfortunately, in this country is always looking to blame someone else for their challenges, their shortcomings. In the case of the FBI, this becomes yet one more investigation. Once the terrible drama is over with, once the body count is done, then the investigators move in and they have to put a case together for court. They have to come up with all of the physical evidence. That's why we're told the synagogue could be closed at least a week, because every bullet that went through a person or a wall has to be documented. And this, of course, will all have to be introduced in court. One more time, this individual is obviously innocent until he's proven guilty of this terrible crime. And the FBI, the local police, and others have to very methodically do their investigation. Just because the individual was caught at the time, shot at the time, we still have to prove this. And of course, that's the way we always want it to be in America.
Now, both men, in both of these crimes, they had such a presence on social media, a prolific digital life, spewing hate online. How fertile will those postings be in an investigation?
I think they'll be very important. Unfortunately, we have individuals who use the internet to both speak to like-minded individuals, no matter how terrible these minds may be, about the commonalities they have in hatred. The shooting at the synagogue will be assumably a hate crime, although There is probably mental disabilities in not only the shooter, but with the bomber this last week, that will come up. But the internet is just a common ground that so many people find to share ideas, both positive and negative. Law enforcement, I think, is challenged, as are the internet providers, the social media groups, to where is that line drawn in the sand? Where does free speech step over the line and it becomes a threat against others that should be some type of a violation of law? I think that's something we wrestle with every day. And in the meantime, I think there are individuals who see hatred posted on the internet, and then many times they want to express it themselves, or that is what actually may help to feed their own hatred. It's there, it's something we live with, and many times I think that the internet and free speech is ahead of law enforcement in their ability to understand who is the next bomber or shooter or killer that we're going to encounter in this country.
Exactly, and these crimes have become politicized, as you well know. We're asking questions about the political rhetoric in this country, who and if it bears some responsibility for the violence that we've been seeing. Do you think that weighs down the FBI and the agencies looking into these crimes?
I think that the political rhetoric can be a basis for some of the crimes that we've seen. The FBI hears it, obviously. Police departments hear it every day. But, of course, the challenge is for both citizens and politicians to come to some understanding that words can incite violence. And that when whatever party one represents, if you suggest anywhere from kicking people to body slamming reporters to whatever the suggestion might be, there are always individuals psychologically that are sitting on the edge of the emotional abyss waiting for a reason to jump off. Many times the rhetoric in this country now, at least the last 10 years, have provided reasons for some individual. And of course, the challenge is that not only do they jump over this abyss themselves, but many times they try to drag us with them.
Clint Van Zandt is a former FBI profiler. Clint, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.